This is Uncle Don on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Today's is the 322nd edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo. A big welcome home to listeners in Lillooet. Life is finally returning to normal there after massive evacuation in the face of threatening forest fires. My wife and I will be in Lillooet next month for their naturalist summer camp, so we'll get to see the damage for ourselves. We hope to meet some of you then. Prince George's city fathers and mothers need their heads examined for echoes. City Council intends to make a bid for hosting the 2015 Canada Winter Games. If we win this privilege, we'll be on the hook to provide, among other amenities, an athlete's village. Are we to overlook the hole that Vancouver dug for itself in building their complex? Oh yes, yeah, such a project will make profit for our city, the same promise made to citizens of Vancouver. Preparing and running Prince George Games would require 6,000 volunteers to be drawn from a pretty shallow pool of local enthusiasts. The city would be expected to kick in some $3 million for facility infrastructure, a cost to be added to taxes, or the debt already borrowed to pay for Terrace and Gas's distribution network. Yeah, put it all on the Never Never for tomorrow's citizens. Oh yes, they would require another $12 million from the city in hosting costs. They hope that a provincial government 6 years hence will be willing to throw in $11 million. Who can tell what their attitude will be? We could be stuck with that bill, too. Ah, but Prince George would receive great benefits. Games would attract 4,000 athletes and 120,000 visitors. That is, if anyone still has a job in 2015 and if gasoline is less than $10 a liter. Where would these visitors stay? Who would profit and who would pay for the inconvenience? You figure it out. Prince George citizens should reject the idea of making such a commitment out of hand. 35 years ago, America's hated President Nixon was forced to resign. Contrary to his protestations, this man was indeed a crook. Not just a crook, but a war criminal guilty of sending many thousand American soldiers to grisly deaths in Vietnam, not to mention the uncounted number of Vietnamese murdered. Nixon continued the program of Lyndon Johnson, adding escalation to escalation until 500,000 American soldiers infested that sad country. That war, begun under false pretenses, ended in a poorly disguised defeat. Now we're at war against Afghanistan, having important parallels with that Vietnam War. A significant difference for Canadians is that we have been overtly dragged into this one, rather than just profiting from supplying the American military machine. Thank you, Jean Chrétien. Obama inherited this war from George Wanker Bush, and he follows Nixon's footsteps by escalating American involvement. But the word escalation has earned a bad rep, so the same phenomenon is now a surge. The effect is identical. More soldiers, more resentment from locals, more coffins returning. Planners decided that just running about the Afghan countryside, dodging mines and killing anyone looking suspicious wasn't making progress. Now, rather than engaging in random mayhem, they're adopting a three-pronged approach, as they say. They will attempt to win hearts and minds of Afghans. Where have we heard that one before? They want to increase development of indigenous forces. That also is familiar, as they tried it in South Vietnam. Over there, the National Liberation Front didn't need to train their fighters. They got them to enlist in the South Vietnamese Army, then desert to the opposition once they were proficient. They will attempt to eliminate corruption from the government, so riddled with graft that nothing works at all without money changing hands under the table. American generals in Afghanistan plan to take soldiers from isolated bases and integrate them in towns and villages where the locals will welcome them with open arms. Sure, someone toked some good stuff to come up with that idea. Now the Taliban can kill them in their beds. If we have any sense, we'll make sure that Harper fulfills his pledge to extract our soldiers by 2011, if not before. If we don't pull them out, there'll be more coffins, more ramp ceremonies, and more billions spent before we're finally forced out of Afghanistan with our tails between our legs. Is there no end to expense in the next year's Olympic party? Here's the latest. Lightning ignited a fire on Blackcomb Mountain, close to the site of Whistler ski events. We were assured that resources were being diverted from other forest fires devastating the province, of which there were 800, to save scenery for the games. This diversion surely warmed the hearts, and possibly homes, of those in communities like Lillooet and Bella Coola, shortchanged when men, planes, and equipment were sent to keep the Olympic venues pretty. As preparation costs soar, the Vancouver Olympic Organizing Committee is begging corporations to contribute labor to the Games. All they have to do is to continue to pay some 1,500 employees while diverting them to Olympic work. Vanek claims that such work will be invaluable experience for employees. Right. So what is in it for companies, their stockholders, and customers? Will they get a pat on the head and a plaque for the wall? Who will perform needed work in their absence? The committee anticipates a workforce of 1,400 and 3,500 temporary employees, for which they budgeted $140 million. They don't elaborate on whether those 1,400 will be permanent bureaucrats living off the fat of these and future performances. They're also looking for 25,000 volunteers to include those seconded from government branches and private corporations. So here's my question. If you were volunteering without pay or expense account, would you enjoy working side by side with someone making a good wage for the same job? Might you be tempted to tell Vanek to match that wage or kiss your butt? Here's a couple from the Crime Doesn't Pay department. The Bank of America has agreed to pay a $33 million penalty to the United States government for lying to stockholders. When Merrill Lynch fell into severe financial trouble, the Bank of America sought approval from stockholders of both corporations to purchase its business. They assured the 283,000 stockholders that Merrill would pay its executive no discretionary bonuses without Bank of America permission. They received owners' consent, and a takeover was completed on the 1st of January this year. Then it was discovered that Merrill had granted bonuses to its hotshots on the 31st of December to the tune of $3.6 billion as a reward for accumulating $27.6 billion in losses for the year. Such performance obviously was the fruit of rare talent deserving of clandestine rewards. A spokesman for the Securities and Exchange Commission stated, quote, "Companies must give shareholders all material information about corporate transactions they're asked to approve. Failing to disclose that, a struggling company will pay out billions of dollars in performance bonuses obviously violates that duty." Close quote. Oh yes, they were punished. Do the math and you will see that the penalty of $33 million was less than 1% of the illegal Merrill bonuses. Here's an opportunity to do more math. The Bank of America was the largest recipient of U.S. government bailout money. That aid amounted to $45 billion. The fine was $33 million. Figure out how much the penalty dented that gift of public money. The Bank of America isn't the only company having its collective hand slapped. The Securities and Exchange Commission applied a civil penalty of $50 million to General Electric for flagrant violation of accounting rules. Four times during 2002 and 2003, executives cooked the books in order to make itself more attractive to investors. Going back over the finances from 2001 through 2007, accountants found profits overstated by $280 million. In defending itself, GE turned over almost 3 million pages of documents and spent $200 million in legal and accounting fees. That cost, plus the fine, would seem to be both a punishment and deterrent. But whose pockets did this come from, and who benefited? Stockholders, lulled into investing in the company by phantom earnings, lost about two-thirds of their value in the market meltdown. Executives, whose bonuses were based on false profits, walked away with millions that will not be retrieved. As the shadow used to say, the weed of crime bears bitter fruit. Investors are again bullish over big bank stocks, which rebounded nicely from last year's collapse. Some analysts are candid in their explanations. They tell us that large banks like Canada's, for instance, are making good profits as they are increasingly exhibiting oligopolistic traits. In an oligopolistic situation, a few companies control the major part of a market and can, in cooperation, act almost with the impunity of a monopoly. None dare undercut its competitors, as any price reductions will be matched and all will lose. On the upside, all follow the leader, content to anger customers as they have no choice. Our local gasoline stations are a beautiful example of an oligopoly at work, all playing the same tune down to the last mill. Banks exhibit the same tactics. Over time, they've collected a growing spread between what they pay for deposits and the interest rates charged on loans. Anyone with bank dealings knows of their nickel and dime tactics for sucking money from customers. Just a couple of months ago, a friend opened a tax-free savings account at the TD Bank. He put in the full $5,000 allowed, only to find on his first statement that he had been charged a $50 fee for some unfathomable service on the account. Considering that the account probably paid less than 1% interest, he would lose nominal principal on his $5,000, even as 2% inflation ate away $100 in buying power. He would have been better off stashing his $5,000 in his mattress. Some years ago, I held a U.S. dollar savings account in a bank in Montreal. As my mother was ailing, I traveled to the States at least once a year, drawing American cash before going and depositing whatever I brought back. I left the account dormant for a couple of years before taking my book in for updating. When I examined it, I saw that every month they had dinged me a small fee, amounting to a hefty chunk of my savings over time. When I protested, the teller said, "Didn't you read the fine print?" I suppose that when I signed up for the account, I neglected to notice that they would screw me out of my principal rather than pay me interest. Silly me. I closed the account that day and henceforth kept my U.S. money in a safe deposit box where nothing could get at it but moths and inflation. Decades ago, Tom Lehrer wrote and sang a song he called "The Vatican Rag," his contribution toward selling the product. Then the Roman Catholic Church had more influence in money than today, so fresh innovations are needed to secure revenue and sell the product. New priests are rare, donations are down, and expenses up. Before the Vatican is forced to sell their silverware, something must be done to bring in cash. What to do? Bring on Pope Ratzinger. Watch out, Beatles, here comes God's front man. Geffen Records, a label which earned its cachet with such as Elton John and Guns N' Roses, has signed the Pope for a CD. He'll be strutting his holy stuff with such favorites as Marian Prayer and litanies in Italian, Portuguese, French, and German. The album, to be called Alma Mater, will be out in time for the Christmas rush by the faithful. Proceeds from sales will allegedly go to charity, after deductions for expenses, of course. The Sistine Chapel won't be on the real estate market yet. Sarah Palin, America's favorite dingbat, is noted for her immortal response to the ecological crisis. "Drill, baby, drill." But there lurks inside every idiot a spark of sense. Sarah exhibited a belated concern for the environment in her attempts to get Canada to clean up an abandoned mine site in northern British Columbia, leaking toxins into a stream feeding an important Alaskan salmon river. The old Tasequa Chief Mine has sent an estimated 16 tons of heavy metals downstream since its abandonment 60 years ago. With renewed pressure from Alaska and the U.S. government, will Gordon Campbell finally cap this toxic waste flow? Maybe after the Olympics are paid for, eh? Or perhaps he will use some of the windfall from his new HST, or hated sales tax, when it begins to roll in. According to documents leaked to the NDP, the Liberal government carefully hid a massive deficit in health care funding, which they now plan to address by closing at least 5 operating rooms in the Fraser region, the province's fastest growing. Remember the promise to cut waiting lists? These closures will reduce the number of operations by about 10% and the lines will grow longer. Urgent cases go to the head of the queue, while those with less critical problems see the line grow ahead of them. Perhaps the tactic chosen is to put off those other operations in hopes that the patients will die. The well-to-do can always bugger off to the States and pay cash. The poor can stand in line and rot. Here's another example of financial acumen of our economist Prime Minister. Canada's launching a challenge to the European ban on Canadian seal products. His World Trade Organization case is expected to take 3 years and cost our government upwards of $10 million. The seal hunt brought in about $1 million this last season. Has it occurred to our governing geniuses that it could be more cost-effective to pay hunters $1 million a year while training them for jobs in areas that will not offend our trading partners? This fight is reminiscent of the vast amounts we spent to stamp out poppy growing in Afghanistan, turning farmers into Taliban fighters in the process when we could just buy their crops for less. While we burn poppy fields, hospitals around the world lack painkillers to alleviate suffering. More economists at work. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. The following comments are blatant time fillers from a rambling mind. When I was a kid, once in a while I would accompany the family on a trip to New York City. That was not as daunting as it may sound now, as we lived across the Hudson River in a New Jersey suburb. I don't remember much of what we did there, but I do remember one thing. A kid did not go into the city unless dressed in a miserable little suit. How styles change, and for the better. So people don't do peacock imitations anymore. Big deal. Now you can go most places dressed comfortably. We never wore jeans to school. Back in those days, jeans were dungarees and were worn only by working farmers. We had to dress for school, then come home and change into play clothes. That was a real nuisance. When I was in grade school, girls didn't wear makeup, and boys didn't wear trousers cut for Siamese twins with underwear showing. Well, that stuff comes and goes and does no serious harm. I've seen occasions where customary standards of dress clash. Never was that more evident than when I crossed Turkey in the 70s. I was part of the group following the Gringo Trail, a common path between Istanbul and Darwin, Australia. We dressed, I would say, casually. No, sloppily. Jeans with holes, threadbare army jackets, beaten-down runners were our uniforms. As we passed the farms of Turkey, there would be the farmers trudging behind oxen and wearing suits. Not Sunday going-to-meeting suits, but suits with jackets nonetheless. We wondered as we sped by what those farmers thought of the ragged hippies, each probably carrying as much in cash and traveler's checks as their farms earned in a year. If those vagabonds had money, why didn't they have suits? If those farmers had no money, why did they have suits? Never the twain shall meet. More than dress codes clashed as we passed through distant lands. I've been told by other travelers that foreign watches were in demand and would fetch a good price in India. At that time, the country was favoring domestic watchmakers, but their products were not very good. So, in Singapore, I shopped around and bought a couple of nice but plain Seiko wristwatches. When we arrived in Delhi, I visited a market where such goods were traded. Full of enthusiasm for the profit I was about to make on my fine Japanese watches, I offered them to traders. No one was interested. I couldn't figure it out. What was wrong? Finally, someone told me that my serviceable timepieces lacked the treasured word automatic. These bits of machinery were not coveted for their ability to tell time, a concept that was not entirely grasped by most citizens anyway, but for show. Another Westerner told me of being accosted by an Indian stranger who insisted on offering him a lot of money for his watch. He explained that the watch wasn't working well, but the stranger wanted it because it was gaudy. Go figure. Many years ago, Prince George had a local Greenpeace group during the height of their campaign against the slaughter of seal pups. One cold winter evening, a girlfriend and I were on our way to a meeting at the late United Way building when I noted she was wearing her usual well-worn coat. I persuaded her to stash the coat. I figured that attending a Greenpeace meeting in a sealskin coat would have been in poor taste. The American and Canadian governments have invested, or more likely given, billions of dollars to General Motors in an attempt to rescue the company. More and more people are questioning who or what is being saved. Is it stockholders? Their holdings are close to worthless. Bondholders? I don't know. Now, how about workers? Look at the figures. In 1979, General Motors employed 468,000 laborers. By the end of this year, after massive restructuring, GM expects to have about 40,500, around 9% of that former number. Would it not have been wiser to let our dinosaur company go into bankruptcy? Successful companies like Toyota or Volkswagen could have bought their facilities, retooling them to produce the cars that North Americans want. In retrospect, it appears that this bailout was enacted in haste and panic. It brings to mind the old admonition, act in haste, repent at leisure. Gordon Campbell needs all the revenue he can scrape up to fight a multi-billion dollar deficit this year. The HST will be picking our pockets, but not for another year. What to do in the near term? One brilliant piece of work is cutting royalties on publicly owned natural gas, a gift to his supporters, and another giveaway of our natural resources. Natural gas is touted as the cleanest burning of fossil fuels. It heats our homes and extracts bitumen from Alberta's tar sands. It's a feedstock for plastics, fertilizers, pesticides, and pharmaceuticals. It runs electric power plants. Natural gas is suffering a temporary glut of production, temporarily driving down its price. But the fact remains that this valuable resource is finite and dwindling. In the future, the nation with supplies of gas in the ground will have a leg up in an energy-starved world. In the face of this knowledge, our clever premier declared that the initial royalty on new natural gas wells is to be all of 2%. Even profligate Alberta charges 5%. Supplies of natural gas belong to the people of Canada and are extracted with our permission. Our government should not be pursuing the short-term advantage of creating a small amount of economic activity and a few jobs by giving away the people's property. We see the reaction of certain residents in the Dawson Creek area to rampant exploitation of gas without landowner consent. They've exhausted legal resources, and someone or group has taken matters into their own hands. Is it possible that Campbell's giveaway royalties on new wells will trigger more drilling in populated areas? If so, may we expect more bombings and sabotage? We face a double problem here. With increased exploration and production, citizens will be angered in our natural heritage depleted for short-term corporate advantage. Any government with a perspective beyond the next election would be husbanding this precious gas while giving careful consideration to the environmental destruction of removing it. In this, and as in so many other areas, our government is not serving the public good. We all know that the Iraq war is being fought for oil, but the Afghan mission, not war, is the good fight to free women of that tortured land, educate its children, eliminate ignorance and corruption while granting the people the gift of democracy. Bullshit. The Afghan war is no different from other colonial wars. It's fueled by a desire for strategic bases and resources. It's obvious that many of the American bases are not temporary. They are there for the long haul, no matter what factions form future government. Under their watchful eye, pipelines will be laid and natural resources exploited. To date, the products we associate with Afghanistan are pomegranates and opium, but there's much more under that troubled land. Afghanistan's appointed Minister of Minerals and Industries stated, quote, "In 5 or 6 years, we hope that Afghanistan can stand on its own 2 feet through mineral reserves," close quote. Those include oil, gas, and one of the planet's largest unexploited copper reserves. The puppet government has granted a license to a Chinese company to exploit the copper, while vast iron ore deposits are up for grabs. Oil and gas lands are also on the block for bidding. These may also go to the Chinese, as they give bigger bribes to government parasites. The Chinese are not stupid, but we certainly are. We send the soldiers to die in Afghanistan. The Chinese lend us the money to fight an unjust war. Then they step in and reap the rewards. I see a parallel here with past empires, expending their dying strength in futile attempts to retain their power, even as rising nations reap the fruits of their efforts. I remember the promises of great benefits everyone was to see from the growth of globalization. A rising tide lifts all boats, declared the capitalists and their political dependents. For a while, it seemed there might be truth to their claims as cheap imported goods became available and jobs were created in nations where poverty was rampant. Then came the downsides. Those overseas earnings were frozen at poverty levels by international competition. Meanwhile, well-paid work in developed countries moved to the third world, and our manufacturing industries died. Western consumers splurged on imported goods even as their wages stagnated and debts grew. Our government revenues suffered, a situation aggravated by the Reagan-Thatcher campaign of cutting tax rates to benefit their supporters. Now that financial collapse has exposed the underbelly of neoliberal economic doctrine, we're stuck with the legacy of decades of misrule. Those in developed countries who overbuilt their lifestyles on debt are being repossessed. Our governments are trying to jumpstart distorted economies, combating a debt-caused crisis by spending yet more billions or trillions of borrowed dollars. This I would call the homeopathic economics, treating a disease by applying medicine causing similar symptoms. It doesn't work in medicine, and there's scant reason to believe it will work in finances. homeopathic economics, like its medical namesake, may appear to work through the placebo effect, but in the long term, it may eclipse an ailment that will only come back in more virulent form later. National leaders met to declare their opposition to national protectionism, then scurried home to subsidize local businesses and inhibit imports. One of the first to be hit was Canada, suffering double hits from tightened American so-called homeland security and the Buy American clause laid on stimulus projects by their Congress. The tightened border and legal impediments are pressuring American corporations to move manufacturing and services back to home turf. A prime example is the way U.S. Steel closed its newly purchased Stelco Canadian mill and moved production south. This, in spite of guarantees the parent corporation made to the Canadian government when ownership was expatriated. Third world countries suffer more than us as jobs that were outsourced are drawn home. Globalization is dying as surely as has Bush's global war on terror. The new empire is rising, making its own rules by which we will find ourselves bound as second-tier powers. The perfidious Hugo Chavez is at it again. His government will buy dozens of military tanks from Russia. Just goes to show you he intends to take over all of Latin America, eh? But let me confuse this conclusion with facts. Venezuela's neighbor, the narco state of Colombia, it has a deal pending that will see more American military presence, more American bases near its border. Allegedly, these troops and posts will be used to fight the narcotics trade, but Venezuela sees this as a dagger pointed at its heart. The Yanks could use any excuse to invade their country and install a compliant regime that would turn over their oil resources over to American companies. I'm sure the military coup in Honduras made Venezuelans nervous, as the American empire is seen to begin restoration of dictatorial rule over Latin America. Obama is watching as his rival, China, makes economic incursions into the area the U.S. once claimed as its own under its policy of manifest destiny. The U.S. will not yield its empire without a fight, and that fight can only leave Latin Americans as collateral damage. This has been the 322nd edition of the Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia.